What was your role in the writing of Dr. Strangelove?
Well, Stanley Kubrick had read a book of mine, The Magic Christian, which was a great favorite, apparently, of Peter Sellers, because he used to buy 25 copies at a time and send them out, birthday presents and Christmas presents. And so when Stanley decided, you see, what had happened with Strangelove was that there was this book called Red Alert, which was a straightforward melodrama on the fail-safe of the fail-safe genre of what could go wrong and cause a catastrophic accident. And it was written by a man who used to be in the RAF intelligence. And it was very authentic in terms of its, you know, the detail, the mechanics of it. But after reading the first draft, Stanley realized that this was just too heavy to be treated in the conventional suspense adventure manner, because it was categorically outside of anything that had ever been done before. It was just too heavy. And so he decided, well, the only way to go is to make it into a satire, like a black comedy. And so he got me over to England to rewrite the script. And that's how I got involved, because he had read something of mine and knew that I had that kind of, or felt that I had that kind of humor.
It's quite a task to make a comedy out of nuclear holocaust, and that was a task you were given then. So what did you think about when you had to figure out what kind of humor you were going to be using in it, and like where there were going to be sight gags, and where there was going to be like bizarre personalities and one-liners, and how it was going to all combine? What did you think about when you were mapping out the kind of humor you were going to use and where and how it would be applied?
Well, it's a combination of concepts. There's the basic thing of that something is so painful that one must laugh in order not to cry. There's that concept. And then there's the classic notion of the theater of the absurd, where situations are so absurd that they're inherently funny. I mean, they may not appear to be funny to the people who are dying, but they are, nonetheless, to the observer, because the only value they can have is, aesthetically, is that of the ultimate in the absurd. That is to say, if man were to destroy himself just on a principle, then in the conscious mind would no longer exist to celebrate or enjoy this principle, then it would be the ultimate in the absurd. So the way to do it, of course, if you have a situation like that, as you do with when people are talking about limited nuclear war or that sort of thing, is to just play it as straight as possible and don't let on that it's a comedy. It will emerge as hilarious, you know. I mean, you can't imagine that, and a lot of people can't understand that, but you just have to take my word for it. If the basic situation is absurd, then you play it straight, and you'll see that it's very, very funny.
I remember one of the things, the first time I saw the movie, one of the things that really stuck out in my mind, and you know how you play back bits from movies for your friends and family after you've seen it, and you just, yeah, you know, take the parts of the people in it was when George C. Scott puts his two fingers in his mouth and whistles for God, and he says, "Hey, God," and he whistles. And it really, it reminded me of so many, like, nightmare American tourists in other countries who just starts, you know, screaming for, you know, "Hey, you, I want a..." You know, blah blah blah, and this really just aggressive mentality of, like, you know, you.
Well, he wasn't. No, he was trying when he did that.
He was saying a prayer. I mean,
he was trying to get their attention, the attention and quiet of the people in the war room who were celebrating, and he was trying to quiet them and he got up on the chair, and then he said, "I'm not much of one for, but we have heard the wings of death." Blah, blah, blah. Yeah. Yes, he was, well, I thought there might have been times where he was a little too broad in his interpretation. Like, I mean, we had a couple of arguments, Stanley and I, about where it might have gotten too slapstick. The classic one was when Colonel Bat Guano, when Peter Sellers talked him into getting some change out of the Coke machine, and he blasted the Coke machine, and then the Coke sprayed in his face, which is right out of kind of, you know, the worst kind of sight gag. But and I thought that weakened. I thought little things like that would threaten the credibility of the thing. But it seems to have survived.
What do you say to someone who says, how can you make light of nuclear war? How can you make a joke about it? It's such a serious thing.
Well, that's because it's so serious that you can't treat it in the conventional way. You cannot treat it as a melodrama the way Failsafe did. And if you saw Failsafe, you must know that didn't do anything at all for that sort of tended to glamorize the whole thing of nuclear war and to make it still seem quite feasible that we could have a limited nuclear war and not cut our hair must too much.
Oh, a simple tit for a tat.
Yeah. Yeah.
So you think that film was a failure? Was there a lot of comparisons that were made, because they came out? I don't remember the exact years of each, but they were pretty close to one another, weren't they?
Well, they were so close that that Columbia Pictures was able to get a injunction against their showing Failsafe because they had been there were some obvious lifts, rip-off sections from it, just technical stuff, and no, it was a complete. Complete bust, that film. I mean, was never heard of again. I mean, it ran for whatever, a couple of weeks, because it had some heavy weight actors in it, Henry Fonda, you know, whoever it was. And but it was just another, like one of those Towering Inferno or something. It was trying to put disaster on a level of, well, this is bigger, but it's bigger only by degree. You see, it wasn't saying, it wasn't acknowledging, are you kidding? This is bigger by cat. I mean, it's categorically different because it's the end of the world. You can't, there are no survivors in a nuclear war, and yet they were treating it as though, well, it's just another kind of a disaster, you know, and we'll be able to evaluate this later and do some Monday morning quarterbacking song, but there isn't any Monday morning. See, that's the difference.
What effect do you think Strangelove had? Do you think that it changed people's minds about the possibilities of limited nuclear war?
No, I think I think that it might have changed some people's minds, but I'm not sure, because they were very upset when the movie, the producers, when they found out when they first saw it. And it was being screened prior to release at Columbia in New York, at the production offices there. And also at the same time being screened and produced by the same company was a movie called The Victors, which was another war movie. another, and it was a melodrama, and not about nuclear war, but just about war, but very serious, you know, very, you know, heavy music. And so they, the guy, Carl Foreman, said, because the critics were, all wanted to get into this, to see Strangelove, and it was very hard to, you know, no, just so such a demand to get in, and nobody was coming to see his picture. So he asked them, whereas Columbia had decided, well, let's go with this one, put all the money, advertising budget money, into the Victors, because that's the one where the Frank Sinatra sing White Christmas while this guy's being executed, you know what I'm saying? And they shoot the puppy dog. I mean, just really a lot of silly stuff. And so, but really touching, you know, a lot of pathos. And so you ask about the reaction of people who had come to see it. So the government had heard, apparently, that there was something weird coming on, so some people in uniform started showing up there, you know, two-star generals, that sort of thing. And so I hung around to watch the screenings to see who got their reaction. And I'd talk to them occasionally, and this one guy said, or most of them said things like, We had a man just like that in our outfit. God, I know that type, a rotten apple. And they didn't recognize themselves in it, you see. They thought talking about someone else. So I don't think it really changes. You know, it's hard to say. I mean, it certainly didn't seem to. They're getting ready to lay out these MX missiles, so I don't think it has had too much effect. It has endured because, I mean, it's still relevant, obviously, people. I mean, painfully, unfortunately, it's still relevant. And so they continue to show it. And so in that sense, it's keeping people aware, I guess, but, you know, I don't know that there's anything can be done to affect the, the military-industrial complex is so, God, it's so strong in the propaganda, and they're almost in control of everything.
Which is more important to you as a writer? Not that you should have to choose one over another, but I mean, there's a message obviously that you're trying to get across in the movie, but there's also you know your goal of wanting to succeed in making the script as funny and as powerful as possible. You know, the artistic concerns.
Well, yeah, I think that. I don't think you can deliberately set about to make a statement. Like the French writers, you know, Sartre and Camus, in that school of writing, feel, all right, we'll do something an anti-communist thing, you know, like Sartre wrote Les Mains Sales to indicate that the guy was disillusioned philosophically with communism, because he was, and so he was going to write something. So he set about deliberately, and he wrote it, you know, and it was terrific. But I don't think our heritage, I don't know many American writers who operate that way. No, I think it's, you do something just on a creative impulse level, and if you're attuned to what's happening, and if you have certain values where you don't, you can't accept things that aren't, you know, that don't seem true to you. They don't, they're not of interest. I mean, everything has to be rooted in reality in order to be credible. And if it's not credible, then it's not going to be funny or entertaining or anything. Because you can't take the characters seriously. You can't believe in the characters. And if you can't believe in the characters, then you don't really care what happens to them. And they can't do anything that's funny. And so, yes, I would just go with the creative thing, no matter where it would lead. And sometimes it might lead to something that could appear to be, you know, some kind of antisocial statement or pro-drugs or something like that I really wouldn't consciously say, you know. I mean, I wouldn't consciously advise anyone to take drugs, but something I would write might come out to be interpreted that way, and so I wouldn't. I would say, you know, if someone asked me, "What does that mean?" blah blah blah, I would certainly say no, but still, it could emerge that way. But that's the most. That's the test, of course. No, I would. I'm not. That's the Soviet thing when you. You know, try to. You end up writing pamphlets if you take that approach.
Mm-hmm. I'm talking to Terry Southern. If you're just joining us, you've completed writing another film that was originally going to star Peter Sellers. Now you tell me Alec Guinness will be in it, and that's called Grossing Out, and that's also about the military-industrial complex. Can you tell us a little bit about the focus of that script?
Yes, so I'll have to tell you the origin of it, and just briefly, Peter Sellers. Was a friend of one of the Arab, King Hussein. And so he was invited to this party. It was this weekend party. I think it was the king's birthday or something. And so the king sent these planes around to collect the guests. And there were all these great comfortable planes that were made up like to be like living rooms. And so on the plane with Peter, the one that came to Geneva or London or wherever he was at the time, was this guy who he was sitting next to, and Peter Sellers had this very inquiring mind, and he would try to. He had such a great ear and eye that he could identify people through their voice and something they might be wearing, and would tell usually exactly where they were from. In the world, and where, in the case of Americans, what part of the country, what part of the U.S., or in England, what county and all that. Anyway, he said, well, this chap was indeterminate. I could not determine where he was from. He said, but he was wearing this curious jacket. He said, I thought it was a rocker's jacket. At first it had a bit of glitter to it, had a sheen. And he said, and he noticed I was looking at it, and he said, oh, you like this jacket? Feel the material. And I felt it, and it was sort of a lamé. It felt like a lamé, kind of a silver cloth. And then I noticed the buttons, and the buttons were curious indeed, and they were large, metallic, jagged, sort of a burnished surface top. And I said, well, those are odd buttons. He said, well, these buttons, these are your basic 357 Magnum hollow point shells, which were fired against this jacket while I was wearing it. And he had them made into buttons. And it turned out that this guy, he was Greek, as it turned out later, but what his thing was that he made these bulletproof sports jackets to sell to the Arab leaders, or to just sort of give them to, because it would segue into a sale just further down the line of three or four F-16 jet planes, which cost about $16 million each. And this guy was an arms dealer. And so Peter hung out with him at the party for a couple of days and was fascinated by his operation. And at one point he said, well, my God, man, aren't you a bit uneasy about selling all this stuff to these Arabs? They're going to be used against the Jews, the Israelis. And the guy said, oh no, I sell to the Israelis as well. And so when Peter got back to London or Geneva, he started researching this thing about the sale of armaments, conventional armaments, that is, planes and machine guns and tanks and all kinds of bombs, to the third world, to the emerging nations of Africa and the Mideast and South America, Latin America. And he discovered that it was a huge operation, which had never been written about. There's only one book, really, about it, called Arms Bazaar, that just sort of a documentary book. giving these statistics. But it turned out that about 8 to 10% of the gross national product of all the Western nations, you know, U.S., France, England, etc., is locked into manufacture and sale of armaments to these countries. And supposedly, there's some effort to control where the armaments are going, and they have a thing called the end-use certificate. But it turns out that that's so easily gotten around, it's like a dope drop that you'll sell to one nation knowing it's going to end up at another, and they just pick it up. And the scandalous thing about it was that, is, still is, that whereas they're supposed to be selling and buying for the protection of the country, you know, from invasion of foreign power, they're actually buying to put down opposition within their own country. That's why the best customers, top customers, were Shah of Iran, Idi Amin, Somoza, people like that. And so, and of course the Russians are, and the whole, all the, you know, Czechoslovakia and so on, they're equally engaged in this. And so it's, that's why it's called grossing out, because, and this is just aside from the, now, of course, the even more sinister and monstrous dimension has been taken on with the, that now is back into the nuclear arms race again. Because the, with the, this, when Peter was, had this idea, it was still detente time, you know. I mean, it was before Reagan, before Afghanistan, before the collapse of detente, and while SALT II was still alive and possible. And so now, and this was pre-MX missile, too, but so now it's even gotten more outrageous because... I mean, even more gross, let's say, so that the grossing out is quite appropriate. And when Peter died, the we got Alec Guinness.
So it's a comedy?
Well, it's a comedy, like Strangelove is a comedy, yeah.
When is it going to be produced, you know?
This fall.
Have you been doing a lot of research on the weapons industry? Do you have
Yes,
does stuff like this
research.
Have to be factual? You know, like if someone is able to watch Strangelove or grossing out and say, well, you know, the weapon that you have there isn't really capable of the things that you attribute to it, and someone who was the head of the Defense Department wouldn't legally be allowed to do the things. In other words, if someone could poke holes in some of the information that you give, does that...
Oh, that would weaken it considerably.
It would. So you have to be careful to be really accurate with all the information.
Yes, but that's very easily done with the... It was difficult, more difficult with the... with Strangelove because of the highly classified nature of that stuff. But for the guy who wrote the original... what the hell was his name? Peter something. Had access to being an RAF, being RAF intelligence.
Have a former military officer come on and be a consultant.
Well, and you don't have to do that though in this, because these, they have these arms bazaars where you go, and they're selling these things with. I mean, they have concessions, you know.
Kind of like an booths. Audio show at one of the
terrific.
Downtown hotels.
Yes. Oh yeah, and brochures and like an like
so you've
an automobile.
Gone to these?
Yes. It's a little difficult to get into them. Well, it's not if you have the credentials from that a major studio can get you. And this was put up. Peter was doing being there at the time, right? And Lorimar, who was the studio financing, they put up the money for the pre-production stuff. That is to say, the script and the research. And of course, they have a lot of connections as far as getting. Press cars, any kind of ID that you want to get into anything. You know, I mean, major studios have that kind of money. And so we were able to.
So you went together?
To get, No, I mean, in terms of the research, we were able to... Well, we did go to one together, yeah.
Oh, God, can you imagine what... like, if the people there selling the arms knew that you, Terry Southern, and Peter Sellers were there, you know, perusing the layout, what a nightmare that would be for them. They'd probably be very disturbed.
Yes, well, we went to one, and it was in England. It was in a quiet little... It was kind of Henley-on-Thames, which is an English village about 70 miles outside of London. And it's almost pastoral type thing, exactly as it was during the Elizabethan days, I guess.
See, that's the kind of thing that sounds like a movie scene. You know, I mean, that's the kind of thing that's like really absurd, the two of you going to a big arms convention in the middle of the countryside in England. It's just, it's really absurd. I mean, do you find yourself laughing in situations like that? Or do you just, you know, accept that as being one of those really absurd things?
Oh, well, and Peter was of course, he couldn't resist the temptation to play the, to play like that he was out of uniform or something, you know, that he was Major so-and-so, and just for my amusement, and see if he could get away with it, which he did. And...
Who are you?
Well, I kept well back. No, I was supposed to be a Texas visitor, you know.
This is terrific. I really wish I could have seen it. Let's talk about another one of your movies, and that's Easy Rider, in which you also worked on the screenplay with I think Peter Fonda and Dennis Hopper also.
Well,
wrote that. Who did what
really
in the
much.
Writing of that?
Well, they had. I'll tell you the history. That was. Peter had a series of American International. It's the pictures. It's like the lowest B picture studio in Hollywood. He had about five movies of just these motorcycle movies, you know, Hell's Angels type movies that no one's ever heard of. And so this was to be another one. But he had then met Dennis. And Dennis persuaded him, well, now if you'll let me direct this, we'll make it into something more than just a run-of-the-mill. We'll give it some kind of, make it contemporary, give it some kind of a social, interesting message. And we'll have the thing of that there are these two guys and who, well, at first they were going to do it, that they were going to get away from the bicycle thing and use that they had this stunt automobile, crash, Daredevil auto thing, and where they would crash cars. And the crux of the story would be that they would make a score in Mexico of some kind of controlled substance. It wasn't stated, you know, what. I mean, it was in our minds, it was cocaine, but it could have been anything. But it would be small enough to smuggle, and then they would sell it, and then they would go to Florida and buy a boat and, you know, just be free. And so that was the only thing they had in terms of this story when they asked me to write it.
What direction did you want to take it in?
Well, to give it some kind of odyssey thing, and which, fortunately, the Mardi Gras was going on, so that could be brought into it. And it would just be the, meanderings of a couple of... See, they hadn't at that time. There hadn't been anything done on the Jack Kerouac on the road type thing, which would be, say, psychologically or philosophically the kind of thing, you know, that they would be doing. Except that it would be more contemporary, you know, more up to date, and that it would also have a, you know, that if they got into the wrong place, because there was a tremendous amount of anti. hippie thing going on then, you know, redneck. And so that seemed to be, it just sort of grew. The idea of that Jack Nicholson, I had written that part for Rip Torn because it was based on a character in Faulkner, a young lawyer who, Mississippi, in a small town, who's very brilliant and becomes, he's a Rhodes Scholar, and he goes to Gavin Stevens, is his name in the Faulkner character. And he goes to Oxford and Heidelberg, but he comes back to this little town and practices. And it always seemed to me to be a fascinating character. And so I styled that after him, because Rip Torn was supposed to play that part then. And then he couldn't get out of this other commitment. And so Jack Nicholson took it, and, you know, and the rest is history for Jack, because it was his first... First role. And that,
first,
and
first
that
legit role, I guess.
Legit role, yeah, really.
First non-Roger Corman role.
Yes.
Well, Leonard Maltin, in his book TV Movies, which is an index to movies frequently shown on TV, says that Easy Rider nearly ruined the film industry because every Hollywood scriptwriter was trying to cash in on its success and write Easy Rider ripoff films. Have you seen any of the, or a lot of the... subsequent films that were made, also trying to be a film for our times about the counterculture?
Yes, I've seen a few. I thought it raised the level somewhat of the, I mean, at least killed off those other kind of motorcycles, the Hell's Angels type thing. It made them not very interesting anymore, those, that macho type adventure, and gave it a little more currency, I mean, a little more contemporary legitimacy, because, and it made smoking grass more acceptable, or at least acknowledge the existence of it, and it put them in a sympathetic light. I thought, you know, I mean, it seemed to me that was worthwhile because at that time it seemed that the anti-dope laws of marijuana were especially, you know, barbaric and unrealistic and, mm-hmm. you know, just silly. You know, I mean, it had nothing to do with, I mean, they were still on the level of... a reefer madness, you know, that kind of mentality. I mean, they were thinking of it that way. And so I thought that if you could show two people who were sympathetic and also someone who might have, like the guy that Jack played, might have an emancipating experience, say his first experience with it, could be kind of amusing and pleasant rather than horror, you know, then he would get the horrors that everyone, all the middle class people seem to be afraid of. Oh, my God, what am I going to learn about myself, you know, or something. It's going to all go inward and I'm going to suddenly see
the truth
about myself. Whereas, in fact, under the right conditions, as everyone knows, where there's no pressure or lying out under the stars like that or something, it could be quite a, no reason why it shouldn't be quite a pleasant, relaxing experience, and maybe even something interesting happening inside your head, or, you know, opening it up a little, and without any psychological danger.
I remember a lot of movies from the time where two people would smoke a joint and would get drunk. I mean, that have all the classic, you know, Hollywood alcohol effects, you know, giggling and bad jokes.
Yeah, and double vision.
Double vision, walking around dizzily.
Yeah, well, see, that, I think in that regard, maybe then they began to kind of, I'm trying to remember the ones that I saw that might have been considered
spin-offs. Well, I remember I Love You,
Alice
B. Toklas, which is just like really silly, you know, marijuana brownies type movie. Anyway, let's move on to another film. I'm trying to not run out of time before we cover a bunch of the things that you've done. And for those of you just joining us, I'm talking with Terry Southern, and we're talking about some of the films that he's written and some of the books that he's written. I want to touch on Barbarella, because that's a film that I think Jane Fonda has spent much of her career being embarrassed about, because since that time, she has done movies mostly in which she's been able to be in a movie where she felt that her political point of view coincided with the film. So what kind of interactions have you had with her?
Well, now this
about Barbarella.
The reason she's had occasion to comment on that movie rather than a number of others which she made, which would be equally embarrassing. I mean, I can't remember, Barefoot in the Park, or whatever, they, you know, just sort of silly, where she's the sex, the bit of fluff, empty-headed sex object. It's because it survived, whereas the others did not, you see. I mean, she's got a lot of dumb movies.
It's more extravagant than the others.
But, I mean, Barbarella exists as a movie that's in the repertoire of cinema clubs. I mean, everywhere, all over the world. And not because of, not, I mean, and it was, even before she was famous. It's because it was based on a French thing that was presented in a comic strip format, but very philosophic, and was highly regarded, and in fact, Godard and Truffaut both tried to get options on it, you know, they wanted to do it. But Vadim, at the time, having come off of, you know, something quite successful, was able to get it. And so it has a cult following now, and people have read into it a certain social values and statements, satiric things about, especially about war. I mean, there's a whole section on you know about in the very beginning, a couple of statements about that she's surprised that people are still, that there has been this recurrence, this barbaric notion of war. I mean, when the chief is telling her, you know, about giving her instructions and so on. And so I did see her recently, and she has, since she's learned that it does have a certain kind of respectability, you know, cultish, you know, along with the Texas Chainsaw Massacre. No, I mean, you know, it'll erase her head, and a few serve in things that endure over the ages. She's, she now can see it, and she's a little more... a little less uptight. She never does have very much of a real, what you might call a sense of humor, but at least she's more secure now, so that she can sort of see it, oh well, you know, if they like it, because she doesn't feel threatened by it now.
Let's talk about your erotic spoof Candy. You do two things simultaneously in that book, which are, in a way, contradictory things. I mean, Candy is a book that is a spoof of pornography, yet at the same time is an erotic book. And, I wonder what kinds of things one goes through to try to write a book that makes you laugh and tries to arouse you at the same time, because in some ways those are really contradictory emotions, right?
Right. Well, if you had read my book, Blue Movie, in
which I
took that to,
right.
Actually was an extension of that, of the very problem that you're talking about, where a director, a film director, a famous Stanley Kubrick-type, Fellini-type, he is American, director decides, after having seen a couple of disappointing Beyond the Green Door, Deep Throat type movies, he said, well, what a waste. Someone who of real creative talent should make a movie like, of erotic value, and using beautiful people and artistic lighting and everything, and sets about, and with big names, and sets about to do so with a $12 million budget. And so the story is about that, whether or not, is it possible? Is there something so private, so intimate about love scenes that it's impossible to see them on the screen without them becoming kind of ludicrous? I mean, is it possible to make them romantic, you see? And so I won't tell you how I won't spoil the story for you to telling you whether or not he was able to do that, but it is a genuine aesthetic problem. And you know, if you think that there was some success, or you've heard others say that there was some success.
Well,
in
and
Candy.
I'll tell you how I saw the book. I was I read it when I was really young, about 13 maybe, yeah.
Perfect.
I was babysitting for these people, and you know how everybody, you know, you're babysitting, you try to see what somebody has, you know, lying around. And it was one of their top shelf books, right? And that's right. You like to see what people keep, and no one would ever ask me to babysit for them now, knowing that I would prowl around like this. But really, no, that's the kind of book that, one, I'm sure, wouldn't know whether they should feel, like, proud that they had, because it was this, like, sophisticated spoof, or embarrassed because it's kind of pornographic and you keep those books in the drawer so, like, nobody sees you have them, right?
Fortunately.
You know, it's the book that you can buy and not put a mask over your face at the checkout counter, right? You know how embarrassed people are.
Well, I know, but it was reviewed, you see, very well received in Life magazine, was then reviewing books, and Nelson Algren gave it a rave in Life magazine, and in Time and Newsweek, you know, it also had, so it was taken, I mean, it was made quite respectable, and it was a bestseller. It was number one on the bestseller list for about 3 months. In fact, it was number one when suddenly a pirated edition came out, because its history was... It was first published in Paris, and it existed as this underground book. It was published in Paris in English, but under Olympia Press, who published a number of mostly porn, but did also publish Lolita first, and The Ginger Man, Don Levy's Ginger Man, and some Henry Miller stuff, and some Samuel Beckett. You know, mm-hmm. So I mean, it had it wasn't a total porn operation, but the book was being smuggled into America and England for 3 years after it was published, and so it existed. It was well known, but every American publisher had turned it down, until finally this man Peter Israel at Putnam's, who's my present publisher, came along and said, "Well, let's go for it," you know, and was prepared to take the legal risks, that is to say, of obscenity. And, oh yeah, it was, yes, and but we were able to get enough literary heavyweight commendations, you know, from critics and so on, of saying it is not obscene,
right, well,
so that could be used, so that there was a defense.
What are some of the films you've seen recently that you've really enjoyed?
Oh, recently? Well,
you can exchange that question for a brief list of your all-time favorite movies.
Well, that's... I was thinking of... I just got a bit... Betamax thing with the cat, and so I was deciding, well, what will be the cornerstone of the little cassette library? And so, sure enough, based on the things that were available there in the store at the time, I've got Citizen Kane and all the Jean Renoir films and the Fellini films and The Third Man, and you know, just the ones you might think of, nothing too weird. Well, L'Âge d'Or, some of the early Louis Buñuel things, very good.
Terry Southern, we're out of time. Thanks so much.
Oh, my pleasure.